Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process, hosted by Edward Willett. This episode's guest, Robert J. Sawyer. Well, welcome to the very first episode of a brand new podcast, The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and I should probably start by introducing me. I am an award-winning author of more than 60 books of science fiction, fantasy, and nonfiction for all ages. I'm published by a variety of publishers. My biggest publisher, though, is Daw Books in New York, which is one of the major science fiction and fantasy publishers, of course. And as it happens, my upcoming book is called World Shaper. It's they're calling it a portal fantasy. It actually has a science fiction backstory. But it's a story about a woman who thinks she's living in the only world there is and discovers that, in fact, she's living in a world that she shaped, although she doesn't remember doing it. And someone is now trying to take over her world and, in fact, destroy all of these shaped worlds, because it turns out there are a great many of them. And the only way to prevent that is for her to travel from world to world and to carry the knowledge of each of those worlds with her to the overseer of the entire labyrinth of worlds. That's World Shaper. And one of the reasons that the story appealed to me or came to me was because I am a writer and I'm always fascinated by the creative process, the process of shaping the worlds that stories take place in. And I chose World Shaper, not World Building, because it seems to me that we aren't building worlds from scratch. Nobody can do that unless you're God, and it would take me longer than 7 days. Instead, we take the world that we have and we shape it into something different. We shape it into a place where we can tell the stories that we want to tell. And even if you are writing mainstream fiction, mainstream literary fiction, what you are creating is not the actual world. It is a shaped version of the real world. It is every bit as much shaped as the worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien or my own worlds in World Shaper or in some of my other books, such as the Masks of Agrima trilogy, which I wrote as E.C. Blake, Magebane, which I wrote as Lee Arthur Chain, or my science fiction novel that came out last year and is out in paperback now, The Cityborn. All of those were shaped worlds, and all of them are shaped to be quite different from ours, but even if I had written a story that was set in ours, I would still be shaping the world to my own ends. Hence the name of this this podcast, The World Shapers. I've got exciting guests lined up already. I can't wait to carry this podcast on indefinitely. I love talking to other authors about how they write and what they write. And the premise is going to be that I will talk a little bit about the author's background and how they came to start writing, and then we're going to focus, in a typical episode, we will focus on a specific book. And we'll find out exactly how a particular book developed and some of the challenges along the way, as well as the process of revision and editing and all that good stuff that writers like to talk about. And I think it will be interesting to anybody who is either a writer or a reader of one of the writers I will be talking to. And that's how this is all going to go. The World Shapers, welcome to the very first episode. And I hope you enjoy the ride. I'm sure I'm going to. So my first guest ever on The World Shapers is Robert J. Sawyer, and I'm going to give a little introduction. He's one of those people that I sometimes think needs no introduction, but I'm sure there are still one or two people who haven't heard of Rob. Robert James Sawyer is a Canadian science fiction writer, born in Ottawa, now living in Mississauga. He's the author of 21 novels and innumerable short stories, not literally innumerable. Obviously, they are numerable, but it's a large number. And he's the most awarded science fiction writer of all time, with those awards including the Hugo, the Nebula, and the John W. Campbell. He's the only Canadian author to have won all three. His books have regularly appeared on major bestseller lists in Canada. They've been translated into numerable, as opposed to innumerable, languages. Rob is a graduate of Ryerson University, which presented him with its Alumni Award of Distinction in 2002, and in 2007, he received an honorary honorary doctorate from Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario. He's also a popular keynote speaker for conferences of all kinds and an excellent writing teacher, as I have reason to know, since I twice attended week-long Writing with Style writing classes taught by Rob at the Banff Center, out of the second of which came my own Aurora Award-winning novel, Marsiguro. So welcome to the World Shapers, Rob.
Thanks, Ed. I'm delighted to be here.
And thanks so much for being my very first guest on this brand new podcast.
That's an absolute pleasure. And the next time somebody introduces me, that will be the honor they start with. Robert J. Sawyer, who was the first ever guest on Edward Willett's famed World Builder, the World Builders podcast, ..
Yeah, well, we can hope. Now, a little later on, we're going to focus on specifically the Neanderthal. Oh, wait a minute. Before I go any further, do you prefer Neanderthal or Neanderthal?
You know, that's very interesting. At the time I wrote the book, so Hominids, Humans, and Hybrids, my Neanderthal Parallax trilogy, came out in 2002 and 2003, the second and third volumes in 2003. And there was a real movement at that time to pronounce the word the German way, which would be Neanderthal, it means Newman's Valley, after the place where the first specimen was found, and to adopt the German spelling of Neanderthal, which after a regularization of German spelling at the beginning of the 20th century, the TH spelling was deprecated in favor of a TA L spelling at the end, tall instead of thal. But, you know, fads come and go. That was a meme of the early 21st century. You talk to most paleoanthropologists today, and you look at most of the literature today, and everybody has gone back to Neanderthal, the T-H-A-L spelling, and most pronounce it Neanderthal these days.
Well, I guess I'll stick with what I'm used to, which has always been Neanderthal. So, but we'll get to that in a minute. I actually want to go way back into the depths of time before we start talking about how you shaped the world of the Neanderthal Parallax trilogy. What was the impetus, first, for your interest in science fiction, and then second, for your desire to write this stuff? Did the SF interest come first, or did the interest in writing come first?
I was born in 1960, so I'm the first generation, I think, of science fiction writers who came into the field through media as opposed to through books and the pulp magazines. The people who are born in the 1950s tended to come through it to the classic, you know, Ace Double books and the pulp literature magazines of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I was hooked by Gerry Anderson's Supermarionation science fiction series, Supercar, Fireball XL5, Thunderbirds, Captain Scarlet, and the Mysterons, and so forth. Meanwhile, in 1967, when I was just seven, I got to see my first ever episode. Actually, I was just six. I hadn't yet had my birthday that year. My first ever episode of the original Star Trek, which was Devil in the Dark, in its very first airing. And I just adored it, even as 6 years old. And to this day, my favorite science fiction media property is Star Trek, the original series. Also in the 60s, there was a real-life space race, right? We were going to the moon. We did it when I was 9 years old. We haven't done it since I was 12 years old, but that's another story. And in 1968, my dad took me to the big G-rated film of that year, 2001, A Space Odyssey. I'm 8 years old, but I was born, as I said, 1960, a year that ended with a zero. Very easy, even at 8 years old, to do the math, to realize that in 2001, I'm going to be 41. My dad, sitting next to me at the time, was 43. In other words, all these wonders of the future that I was being shown at 8 years old on the big Cinerama screen would supposedly be my life before I was older than my father was then. And that combination of things really spurred me on to a lifelong interest in predicting or extrapolating the future of science and technology and what it's going to mean for human beings.
Well, it's interesting because I am, I believe, 10 months older than you. I was born in July of 1959.
And in fact, they were a rough 10 months. I've seen you. I'm just kidding.
And I have more hair than you do.
You have much more hair. More hair than I do.
The moon landing was actually on my 10th birthday, July 20th, 1969. And the Viking landing on Mars was on my 17th birthday in 1976.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Yes.
So I had very much the same background as you when it comes to this stuff.
I remember that famous speech when Neil stepped off the limb. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, and hey, Ed, happy birthday. Don't normally continue the clip to the last part, but I remember
it's been edited out of most of it, yes.
That's right, exactly.
It was a special moment for me. And I also remember all the Super Marionette stuff. Fireball XL5 was one of my big things. And I also did not see Star Trek in the original run very much. I saw one or two episodes, caught up with it in reruns. So we parallel very much in that sort of thing. So when did you actually start thinking about writing the stuff?
I was very lucky. McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, solicited my archives a few years ago. So I went and dug. And the oldest thing I could find is what we would now call a piece of fan fiction, but not for Star Trek, but for Lost in Space, which I also saw during the 1960s. And this, judging by, it wasn't a dated manuscript, but I would say it was 1970 that I wrote my first science fiction story at 10 years old. And it was a Lost in Space story. Throughout the 70s, I really got very interested in wanting to be a science fiction writer. Around about 1972, when I was 12, I read my first ostensibly adult science fiction novel. It was actually what we would call today a YA, and what back in the day they used to call a juvenile, called Trouble on Titan, by Alan E. Nurse, N-O-U-R-S-E, but pronounced Nurse. And by coincidence, he was a medical doctor, so he was Dr. Nurse. It was very much in the mold of the Heinlein juveniles, like Have Spacesuit, Live Will Travel, Pod Cane of Mars, the more Farmer in the Sky, the more famous exemplars. But it happened to be the first one I read. My older brother had it as a used copy that he'd gotten somewhere. He handed it on to me when I was going to summer camp. And it began, even before the story, it began with an introduction by the author, by Dr. Nurse, entitled I've Never Been There, about the joys of being a science fiction writer, and saying, you could do this too. So even before I'd read my first science fiction book, Alan Nurse, one of my great regrets is I never met him before he passed away, encouraged my interest in becoming a science fiction writer. And I really, in a very meaningful way, owe my career to him.
I have to say there are more parallels there. I had older brothers who read science fiction. And the first one I remember was one that my older brother had, which was lying around the house. And it was Robert Silverberg's Revolt on Alpha C.
Yes.
Which he wrote when he was 19, which is really annoying.
Incredible. You know, I never read that Silverberg. It was certainly kicking around at the time. But there was a comparable Scholastic book service book, a slightly larger than normal paperback, called The Runaway Robot, putatively by Lester Del Rey. It turned out it wasn't really written by Lester Del Rey. It was written by Paul W. Fairman, but Fairman was simply a ghostwriter, and he wrote it, and Del Rey's name was the one that it was sold under. And my very first science fiction convention, 1973, so I'm 23 years old, I guess. No, 13, forgive me, 13 years old. And Lester Del Rey's the guest of honor, and I go up and hand it to him and say, this is the book, because it was aimed at kids. I said that the Alan E. Norris was my first adult. It was the first one that didn't have any pictures, right? Aimed at kids. This was the book that got me into science fiction, and I handed it to him and asked him to autograph it, and he took it as though it was a piece of excrement, signed it without a word, and pushed it with the back of his hand toward me. Only years later did I discover that it was a great consternation to him that by far his most famous book turned out to be this one that somebody else had written.
I should also mention that my very first science fiction short story was written when I was 11, so again, almost in the same time frame, and it was called Castra Glass Hypership Test Pilot.
So good title.
My course was set. All right, well, you have written a lot of novels since then. They are not innumerable. There are 21 of them, I believe.
23 out so far. I'm working on number 24.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the Neanderthal parallax. But in a more general sense, what generally provides you the seed from which a novel grows? And then specifically, what was the seed for the Neanderthal books?
In general, it's always, always, always research. I often say that I write science fiction to fund my research hobby. I love just finding out new things, exploring in whatever level of depth I'm interested in them, any given topic. As I say, being a writer is like being a grad student who gets to change his thesis topic and even his field of endeavor as often as he or she wishes. And so for whatever I'm doing, I just spend months and months. I decide on is a topic. And then from that topic, I research it with no preconceptions of what I'm going to find in great depth. I was lucky enough, having sold The Neanderthal Parallax as a trilogy, to be able to spend a full year doing research about Neanderthals before I had to write the first word. Had no preconception about what in particular I wanted to do. For that particular series, I'll tell you exactly how it came about. I was having dinner with Tom Doherty, who was the publisher of Tor Books, the largest U.S. science fiction publishing concern at the time. And he said, you know, we're just chatting, just him and me, dinner, nobody else, we're just chatting. And he said, you know, one of the things that we haven't been doing at Tor, but we want to get into, is licensed properties. We see the success, you know, obviously that Simon & Schuster is having with their Star Trek novels, Del Rey is having with their Star Wars novels. Rob, if there was a property out there that I could acquire, I, Tom Doherty, could acquire for Tor, that might entice you maybe to want to write a book for it, what would that be? And I said, classic Planet of the Apes. I love classic Planet of the Apes, the original five films from 1968 through 1973. And Tom kind of scrunched up his face. He's got this beautiful smile normally, but he said, you know, that's really kind of a depressing series. I said, well, the first book is very depressing. You're absolutely right. And so is the second book, where the whole world is destroyed. And the third book, or the third movie, I should say, where, you know, all the apes are killed by the end. And well, but by the fourth film, the tables are turned, and in the fifth film ends on a note of hope, with humans of all races and ethnicities and all different genera of ape trying to live together in peace. And I said, if you take that as the starting point, these very different kinds of beings trying to make a utopia together, you could have a very positive series. And then he said, quite rightly, well, nobody remembers the fifth film. So it never went anywhere. He did acquire Earth Final Conflict, the Gene Roddenberry series that was being made here in Toronto. And they immediately thought of me. Jim Frenkel was the editor for Tor for that series. They immediately thought of me because I lived in Toronto. So I went down, I toured the sets, I met the producers, got along very, very well with them, and was in line to write the first Earth Final Conflict novel. That series, TV series, began well after aliens had arrived on Earth, and there'd never been a story of their actual arrival. That was backstory for the TV series. And I'd done a number of successful First Contact novels, including, for instance, Illegal Alien by that point, and Starplex by that point. So Tor thought of me to do that, and I really kind of scrunched up my face the way Tom had scrunched up his, and finally said, you know, I don't think I want to do licensed properties. I think what I want to do is go back and create something that would let me do everything that Planet of the Apes did for me as a viewer, as a participant in enjoying the property, which was do social commentary about the human condition from a slightly skewed angle. And what is a slightly skewed angle but a parallax? And so I pitched the Neanderthal Parallax to Tor, and they very happily bought it as my reimagining, if you will, in a completely different way, all of the social commentary infrastructure that Planet of the Apes made possible.
So what was your research? What did it look like? You read lots of books? Do you go to conferences?
Right. Now, this is, again, the early 2000s. So I'm a heavy user of the internet, but it's way before everything was online the way it is today. So there was certainly lots of reading of paper books, lots and lots of downloading articles from the internet. I went to the annual meetings for several years of the Society for the Society for Paleoanthropology, which is a small enough society that it always piggybacks on another conference. They're either on the American Society of Physical Anthropologists or some other group. They piggyback. They're not enough paleoanthropologists in the world to have a big conference. So I went and I got to talk face to face, and I took a couple of side trips to round it out with every major expert on Neanderthals in the world. And just listened to them and said, you know, if Neanderthals hadn't died out, tell me what you think they would have been like today, their civilization. Of course, very different and divergent views. Milford Wolpoff was the primary believer that Neanderthals' DNA had been co-opted into our DNA. That was not by any means a popular view. We're going back 17 years now. Now, of course, it is the mainstream consensus that absolutely we all contain, except for sub-Saharan Africans, some proportion of Neanderthal DNA within ourselves. We interbred with Neanderthals, but that was not a mainstream view at the time I was preparing these novels. And I just listened to them all in as much depth as I could, and I read and read and read, and came up with what would be the cornerstones of my Neanderthal civilization. Number one, back then and even today, despite some recent articles to the contrary, there was absolutely no good evidence that Neanderthals had any religious leanings. Yes, they buried their dead, but they buried their dead in the most perfunctory way possible. You have to dispose of dead bodies because they attract scavengers. They attract disease. They smell. And Neanderthals built, for instance, circular pits in the ground and really just jammed whack-a-mole style the body into the pit to just get the hell rid of it. Whereas we, at the same time, were making elaborate burials. People were buried wearing furs. They were buried with spears that they might need in a putative afterlife. Maybe a haunch of meat because the body was going to be reanimated at some point. And again, this putative afterlife, no sign of that amongst Neanderthals. So one, no religion. Two, there was a paleoanthropologist named Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, Binford, B-I-N-F-O-R-D, Louis Binford, or Lewis Binford. And he had done an interpretation of a site at Combe Granal in France, where he said, you know what, it looks to me here like the male and female Neanderthals lived largely separate lives. Now, of course, the easy quip is, well, that explains why they're extinct, right? But the answer was, he said, there's a real division of labor. You see it here between the hunters and the gatherers. The hunters were the males, the gatherers were the females, and it looks like they didn't even cohabitate. I thought, wow, it's right there, it's in the literature, and that was my requirement. Anything I did with my Neanderthals had to be defensible by pointing to not necessarily the most popular interpretation, but an interpretation that was in the paleoanthropological literature. So that's number two cornerstone, no religion. Sorry, no separate gender lives. Number one was no religion. Number two was that the males and females lived largely separate lives. And the final one was a recognition that Neanderthals were so much physically stronger than we are. This is a commonly referred to in the literature, is that Neanderthals would have Arnold Schwarzenegger's physique without having to work out. And the muscle attachment scars are there on the bones. You can see how incredibly strong these were. Now, you and I, Ed, we've been friends for an awfully long time, and I don't think we've ever had a harsh word between us. But were we to get into a real argument, you and I might have a fight, and we might actually reach a point where one of us took a swing at the other. You might even hit me in the face. Would you kill me? Almost certainly not. You knock me on my keister, I might knock you on yours, and that would be the end of it. But Neanderthals were physically strong enough that a punch direct to the face, a roundhouse into the gut, would be fatal, would be lethal. And I wanted to explore the interpersonal relations, the society that would grow out of having to eschew violence from very early on. Not our society where we went thousands of years, we're really the worst one, thousands of years, we went almost 200,000 years, where really the worst one group could do against another group was throw a few spears or chuck a few rocks, and casualties would always be minimal, and an interpersonal fighting almost never fatal. To a society that for that same 200,000-year period had to deal with the fact that violence had to be tamped down because if it got out of hand, people died. Those are my three pillars. A pacifism, largely separate gender worlds, and a lack of theological belief. Not ever having outgrown the belief in God, which perhaps a lot of people today have would claim that that's their perspective, but rather never having even occurred to them that there was some kind of guiding force behind the random fluctuations of nature.
So with those three pillars, I mean, there's a lot more to the society than those three things. There's things like the companion that everybody carries and the alibi archive and all of that, which presumably does not come from Neanderthal research.
Well, yes, it does in a way. I'll tell you the true origin of that, but I will say it is part of that extrapolation of how you're going to have a peaceful society. Ah. You know, right now we look for the murder weapon, right? We look for the gun, the powder burns. We look for the thing that the murderer has to dispose of, right? To kill somebody. And very often on those occasions where we do effectively convict somebody of murder, it's because, well, I know you said you had an alibi, but in fact, we found the weapon, blah, blah, blah. At the Neanderthals, where literally I could sneak up behind anybody I didn't like, boom, in the back of the head, and they're dead, and then I just scuttle away and wash my hands of the whole matter, that as their civilization developed, there would be a great desire to be able to make sure that that sort of crime was simply not possible. That the murder, so simple, so easy, physically done with bare hands at the whim of anybody, would be constrained. So in that sense, it does come out of the physical strength of the Neanderthals.
So would you say
Go ahead.
Would you say then that every aspect of that society is something that came at least at that level of extrapolation from your research and your actual knowledge about Neanderthals?
Yes. Anything else that it would have been, for instance, I have, you know, in my novel Calculating God, I have a species called the Reed, W-R-E-E-D, and they have an ability to apprehend cardinality at a greater level than we do. What does that mean? It means the average human being, if he or she sees one object, two objects, three objects, four objects, or five objects on a table, doesn't have to count them. You can say the number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, how many are on the table, in exactly the same amount of time. If somebody asks, how many are there? 1, 3, 5. It takes the amount of time. Starting with 6, it takes a little more time. And with 7, 8, 9, 10, incrementally, it takes the same amount of time for each additional object. In other words, the human mind can look at a group of objects, and if it's anywhere between 1 or 5 in that group, we don't count. We perceive or apprehend the cardinality, the number of objects, at a glance. And I had a group that had the ability to do that on a much, much larger basis. They could look and see, I forget now, it's 20-odd years since I wrote the novel. They could look and see their 50 objects without having to count them. And it completely changed their approach to a number of psychological issues. That's an interesting bit of science fictional invention, and I used it in a different novel where I was making up a race from whole cloth. But for the Neanderthal parallax, my guiding principle had to be that anybody who was expert in Neanderthal would be able to read the book and say, ah, I get what he's doing with this. I know whose research, whose paper, which site, which specimen he's riffing on for that part of the narrative. Absolutely, that was my litmus test for what got included and what got excluded.
And what response did you get from all those Neanderthal experts you talked to?
Lovely response. I made friends with some in advance of the books because I met them at conferences. We really hit it off. And later on, a few that I'd only met through correspondence, I got to meet face-to-face. Great friends still. My book is taught at Johns Hopkins, well, the first book, Hominids, Johns Hopkins University, in an anthropology course. Absolutely, the response has been overwhelmingly gratifying.
So now, obviously, you started with constructing your world of the Neanderthals, but that still doesn't give you a story. How do you go from that to a story? How did you develop
characters? I will tell you that in one second, but I do want to address the companion ink plants, where they actually came from.
Okay.
About 20 years ago, and before I did the Neanderthal series, late 90s, I was brought in, along with a few other science fiction writers, by Eastman Kodak, headquartered in Rochester, New York. And they said, this was, 20-odd years ago, we're in trouble. Film photography is a problem, right? People are switching slowly but surely back then to digital. Now, of course, it's almost all digital. We don't know what to do. So we have a Skunk Works, a development facility. We're looking for ideas. We'll bring in some science fiction writers. Help us riff. And the deal was they could have any idea we came up with without constraint, but we could also use any idea we came up with in our fiction without constraint. And I said, here's the number one problem. Your slogan at the time was, it's a Kodak moment. The problem is you don't recognize most of the time that it's a Kodak moment until it's too late. When that car accident has occurred after the collision, it's too late to realize that that was a Kodak moment. Wouldn't it have been great to have a photo of the collision? When a beautiful snowy owl flies right across the face of the moon, what a great Kodak moment. But by the time you get your camera out and the lens cap off, the owl is gone from the sky. I said, what you need is continuous photography, life logging, digital, constant image taking. So at the end of the day, I could say to myself, what were the Kodak moments from the day gone by, and select the photos that I wanted to share or whatever, knowing that I had it all. Everything I had seen had been recorded. And they said, oh, wow, that's great. That's super cool. And of course, never did it. And that was, you know, if the company had listened to me, I honestly think they would still be in business. But it was such an intriguing idea, and it fits so well with the need for accountability in a society where anybody, there's no background checks about whether you're strong enough to kill another person. There are no mental health checks about whether you're strong enough. There's no waiting period before you are strong enough to kill another person. All of the things that swirl around the gun control debate in the United States are irrelevant in Neanderthal society. Every single person is sufficiently armed to kill another person at their whim in that society. And marrying that with this technology that I'd actually first mooted at that ideation session, as it was called, for Eastman Kodak, fit perfectly well for that novel.
I think the way technology is going, we're still going to get there with the continuous recording. It's close now in some ways with GoPros and things like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is why they pay me the medium-sized bucks, because 20-odd years ago I was saying, even to the people, you know, it is so true of technology, right? I mentioned 2001 A Space Odyssey. They had the iPad down pat, except for one detail. It was made by IBM in that film. All right. If you look at the pads that the astronauts aboard Discovery are using, they are made by IBM. And IBM was a consultant in 68 about making flat-screen digital devices, and they dropped the ball, and a company that did not exist in 68, Apple, came along and dominated the tablet market space. So, yes, absolutely, GoPro or some company that didn't even exist when I handed this on a silver platter to Kodak will absolutely dominate the life logging space. 100%. That's the standard model of technology. Almost never does an old technology company transition to new technology well. The gold standard of that right now is Netflix, which started with being a company that mailed DVDs. And you signed up for a queue. I want this one. And then when I return it, I want that one, blah, blah, blah. And they physically delivered DVDs. And they were the ones who said, this is nuts. Let's transition to completely digital distribution. And anybody could have done that, but they did not. Any taxicab company could have given us the convenience of the Uber app, and not a one of them did. So it's always, always, always that model where somebody says, here it is, IBM, we know we could make these pads, but, you know, we didn't get around to it. Kodak, we could have done life logging, but, you know, we're bankrupt now. So absolutely the way it works.
So to go back to the story building.
Yes.
You have a world. What comes for you next? Is it characters, plot? How does that process work for you?
I'm very much a top-down guy. So I had the topic. I'm going to write about Neanderthals and humans. Basically, my topic was one line. A parallel Earth where Neanderthals survived to the present day, and we did not, in a portal that opens up between the two realities. And then I go down to what I wanted to do thematically. And, of course, what I wanted to do thematically was the kind of social comment that Planet of the Apes had let people do, and that classic Star Trek in its best episodes had done. And then I said, okay, what do I really get down to? And when I started thinking about all this stuff, males living largely separate lives, violence, which is generally far more common, physical violence amongst males, even amongst primates, right? All the other primates, than females. I came to this realization that in a very real sense, what I was talking about was masculinity. And I start the trilogy, actually, with a quote. And sometimes people say to me, you know, you're going to hear some key clacks in the background because I'm going to get quote in front of me. Sometimes people say to me, you know, hey, that's kind of an anti-male trilogy, or, you know, men's rights activists get a little pissed off about hominids. And I said, you know, if you should have stopped after the opening quote, because there is an epigram right at the beginning that tells you what I'm doing with this trilogy. I'm going to read it to you. First, I'll tell you where it's from. You skip down to the end of the epigram. It's from a book by Richard Wrangham, Wrangham, and Dale Peterson. And the book is called Demonic Males, subtitle, Demonic Males, Apes, and the Origins of Human Violence. And the quote is this, and it sums up my whole trilogy. The Southern Forests provide the message that it didn't have to be this way. That there is room on the earth for a species biologically committed to the moral aspects of what, ironically, we like to call humanity. Respect for others, personal restraint, and turning aside from violence as a solution to conflicting interests. The appearance of these traits in bonobos hints at what might have been among Homo sapiens if evolutionary history had been just slightly different. I've got my note right here in the master manuscript file. I found that, quote, Tuesday, February 1st, 2000, page 230 of that book, Demonic Males. I had my template. I was going to write about, okay, we didn't have to be this violent. We didn't have to be this mean. We didn't have to be this rapacious. What I'm going to do is construct a novel on that basis. What would it be like if manhood wasn't measured by how violent, how mean, how nasty, how taking all for yourself, life was going to be based on a more gentle version of maleness. And around the same time, maybe even a little bit before that, I stumbled across the magazine American Scientist, not to be confused with Scientific American. American Scientist had a banner across the cover, Evolutionary Origins of Rape, which was quite a provocative title. And I went and read the book that that was an excerpt from, and realized that these people were making a case for there having been some natural selection that led towards sexual violence. So I had a couple of pillars there. I actually wanted to explore, and that book, by the way, I guess it was around the same time, came out in 2000, was called A Natural History of Rape, Biological Bases of Sexual Coercion, from Cambridge, from MIT Press. Randy Thornhill and Craig T. Palmer were the authors of that. They're reprehensible. I mean, I knew women who had been raped. I knew how horrible this was as a concept. And so I had these pillars of a woman, my main female character, in our universe, in the version of reality where Homo sapiens are dominant, who is recovering from a rape, and a male universe that had eschewed all masculine violence, had found a way either preventing it with the companion implants, purging it from their gene pool in a long ago pogrom, or these days simply having raised men to be what now, ironically, 18 years later, with informed consent and the Me Too movement and all of this, that we're finally publicly addressing, hey, you know, we didn't really bring up our young men very well, did we, for generations. I wanted to write about that kind of sexual politics and the politics of masculinity and how we could be better men. And Ponter Boddett, the lead Neanderthal character in my trilogy, is my platonic ideal of what masculinity really is. Caring, compassionate, empathetic, cooperative, non-competitive, and yet clearly male through and through.
So you have your two main characters there. How do you go about building your plot?
Right. So once you've got the two main characters, you've got a woman who is obviously predisposed to have a lot of problems with men, and then you have a man who is utterly unlike any man who is existed in this universe since Neanderthals went extinct 27,000 years ago. You throw them together and you're clearly looking for a conflict of cultures and ultimately for romance. And although I didn't in any way tout the trilogy as a romantic trilogy, one of the reviews that I very much like of the trilogy called it the most unusual romance story you're ever going to read. Bringing the characters together was simply a straightforward process at that point. How did I get the male Neanderthal into our world? Well, I had to contrive a reason why a porthole might open up by the two versions of reality. And then when you postulate anything that's supposed to be a miracle technology, like my alibi archives, the life logging of Neanderthals, I got to thinking, well, what's the flaws in that? The flaws are, what if it ever fails? Where would it fail? Deep underground. What do we put deep underground? We put mines deep underground. Why would a scientist be down in a mine? I know there are scientists down in mines right now. They're in Sudbury, near me in Ontario, doing neutrino research. Deep down in mines is a great place to shield from solar radiation, from gamma rays, from gamma ray bursts, from things like that, cosmic rays. And so we would put delicate physics laboratories, whether they're neutrino observatories or maybe quantum physics facilities, deep underground. And that's what I have in my Neanderthal world, the same place where we have the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, a naturally rich mining site. We have, with extremely low background radiation, we have a quantum computing facility where it has to be delicately shielded from radiation, lest decoherence occur, the whole quantum physics, quantum computing experiments collapse. And I contrived an experiment that tried to factor huge numbers, couldn't do it within the confines of one universe. The quantum computers reach across into multiple universes, and lo and behold, the experiment crashes, but not after having temporarily created a portal that dumped a Neanderthal into our Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, which lo and behold is filled with heavy water, and my guy almost drowns. He's injured, he's saved, he recovers. They bring in a paleoanthropologist woman who was my female rape survivor, because she's the foremost expert in Neanderthal DNA, to identify this guy and confirm that he really is what he appears to be, a Neanderthal, and thereby hangs a tale. You've got it all in motion at that point.
It sounds like you follow a process that whenever I'm talking to people about writing, it's always a process of asking yourself questions. You ask the question, what would be the flaws in this alibi archive system that you could exploit for story purposes? Then you start asking, well, if somebody did pop into the neutrino observatory, into that heavy water, what would happen? And do you think that's fair, that it's a constant process
absolutely.
Of asking yourself questions?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I will say, Theodore Sturgeon is most famous in our field for Sturgeon's Law, which is 90% of science fiction is crap. But then again, 90% of everything is crap, right? But he also famously said, ask the next question. It was his process as well. Okay, you've said that. You know, here's the easy question. You've given the easy answer. What's the next question? What's the next answer? Very Socratic dialogue. And it's no coincidence, by the way, that one of my all-time favorite novels, movies, and TV shows outside of the science fiction field is The Paper Chase. The Paper Chase is about the use of the Socratic method, asking questions and answers in an endless stream, to teach law, in particular contract law, at the Harvard University Law School. I mentioned I just didn't type one little thread in our earlier conversation. So I had these wonderful alibi archives. They're not working down at the bottom of this mine shaft because there's no way to transmit the signal out, right? Everything is shielded from incoming and outgoing radiation for the purposes of the Neanderthal quantum computing experiment, which means for the brief time that the Neanderthals are down there, there's no record of what had actually occurred. And lo and behold, one of the two Neanderthal researchers disappears, body gone, lost. Of course, it's moved over into our universe. And so it sets me up also for one of my favorite paradigms, which is the murder mystery story. The other Neanderthal researcher gets charged with the murder. The body is gone. There's no record what have happened. It was one of the very few times somebody could have gotten away with a murder with no record of what having had occurred, no life logging what having had occurred. And so I have a desperate need for the Neanderthal who is left behind to try to recover the Neanderthal who has moved to our universe, right? It all asking question after question after question is the way it works.
When you have, when you're, before you begin writing, do you have a very, very detailed plot synopsis, or do you do some of it on the fly, at least, as one thing suggests another as you're writing?
I do a lot of it on the fly. The reality is, at the beginning of one's career, nobody will buy a novel from you unless it's entirely finished. And in that sense, the process is a black box. No editor ever asks, oh, how did you happen to write this? They just judge the finished work. Later on in your careers, you know, sample chapters and an outline might be enough to procure a contract for writing a novel. And then so you are forced to have an outline that's coherent and readable by another human being who's going to judge whether or not to buy or commission that book. Even later on in your career, if you're lucky, you reach a point where they don't ask for anything. They don't even ask for an outline. They just say, okay, it's time for another, in my case, Robert J. Sawyer book. And since I'm not contractually obligated to provide an outline, I don't tend to do a lot of work preparing an outline, and that always is much to my regret. It would always be much easier if I'd sat down and focused earlier on than finding myself writing down some blind alleyways later on in the process. But as it happens, I'm a big advocate of detailed outlining, but I'm not a big advocate of, I'm not a big practicer of what I preach. I want to say something a little bit about creative differences here, because so many writers, I don't know if you do, Ed, so many writers these days belong to writers groups.
I never have.
I never have either. And you will find Robert Charles Wilson never has. Most of, you name most truly successful science fiction and fantasy writers of the last 25 years, which is the only period in which writers groups have been common. They became common as an unintended consequence of cheap laser printers, so you could easily make copies for people in your group, or later for easy distribution of electronic copies that people were actually content to read online, right? They're a recent phenomenon, but most of the major writers that you can name never have and never would contemplate belonging to one. The standard template of a writer's group, though, is, we did this workshopping at Banff, you bring in a portion of a work, everybody reads it and gives you feedback on that portion of the work. And then you maybe go off and you write more, and it's a back and forth, and there may be some value in that. There's certainly value in it for a week, which is why I'm happy to run week-long seminars and workshops. But as an ongoing process, I don't think it is the correct way to do this. I was lucky enough that in 2009-2010, ABC in the States made a TV series based on my novel Flash Forward. And I was lucky enough also to get to spend time in the writer's room for that series and to write one of the episodes for the TV series. That process, television, is all about asking the next question, brainstorming, the kind of brainstorming that I do solo, we would do in the writer's room. Somebody would say, okay, so say that Simon has this device in his ring. I never liked the device, but we have this device in his ring that prevents him from falling unconscious when other people around him fall unconscious. Why would it do that? And I would say, well, you know, it could be a quantum entanglement device. Oh, we could call it QED, blah, blah. There would be a back and forth question and answer, a constant interrogation of whether we had found the right idea, the best solution, and in a good writer's room, such as the one David Goyer ran for Flash Forward. He was our showrunner. In a good writer's room, doesn't matter if you're the most senior writer or the showrunner or the most junior writer or the script assistant who's just there to type up notes, the best idea wins. Not, you know, the most senior person's idea trumps everybody else. The best idea wins, wherever it comes from. That's the process. And writing for television is all about outline. Everything has to be, we call it, beaten out, beat by beat, moment by moment of the action before a single line of script or dialogue is written. You have an incredibly in-depth outline that you beat to death, and then it goes to the network, and the network will say, well, the studio first and then the network, and they give notes and they say, oh man, that's going to be too expensive at the studio level. And the network will say, you know, that's all well and good, but people really like this character John Cho is playing. Can't you give him more to do in this episode? Blah, blah, blah. And you go back and you hammer it out. The process, though, the key points of the Socratic method, question, 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 and plotting everything out in enormous detail, is much more how television is normally written. It is, I think, the ideal way to also write novels, but most novelists, even in a writer's group where you think they would get that kind of feedback, don't, because they hand in a fait accompli. Here's my entire 5,000-word chapter. Did you like it? Not, okay, now we go to line two of this chapter. Did I say it right? Is this piece of dialogue correct? But what if happened here? No, don't do that. Do this instead, which is what would happen in a TV writer's room.
Well, that brings up my next question, which was the rewriting process and also the role that editors play in your books. What have they done for you? And what is your own rewriting revision process?
I am a huge believer in rewriting. My first draft, I even sometimes refer to it, I think I got this term from Ado Van Belkom, as the vomit pass, where all you're doing is whatever's welling up inside you, you get it out as fast as you can, and it's an unpleasant process getting it out, but you know, you actually do feel better once it's out, right? And I get it down because ideas are fast and fleeting. Right. You know, you get interrupted. You know, this is a writer, right? If you get interrupted by a phone call, somebody interrupts your train of thought. You come back to the keyboard. Oh, crap. Whatever it was you had is gone. That thought is gone. They're evanescent. They only last for a moment. They're gone. So the vomit pass is trying to get everything out of my head into a form where I can no longer lose it into my computer as fast as I can. But then I do many drafts, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 drafts, whatever it takes. My goal in life is to give a manuscript to my editor where the editor has one word of response. Great. I don't want the editor to have to engage with flaws in my manuscript. I want to have so deeply interrogated the manuscript myself, and yes, had enough beta readers look at the material that I have corrected whatever flaws are there. I feel it's, in fact, is incumbent on me to hand my editor my best, most polished work, not a hot, steaming mess, and say, well, what should we do with this? Now, most of my books actually have been published with no editorial changes whatsoever.
Wow.
Whatsoever. The big exception to that was when I was working with David Hartwell at Tor. David, in fact, was very much a hands-on editor, very handsy in a way that might be considered, was considered by me and a number of his authors to be intrusive. So we'll do this, change that, drop this. Why? Does it make it better or does it simply make it different? Which is always my razor for testing whether is it different or is it actually better. And in a number of cases, and this will be a different story for a different podcast, I felt David materially harmed my novels. And it took me a while to reach the point, and it was only on the last book I did for him where I stood up and said, I'm not going to make those changes. And I moved to another publisher, not entirely unrelated to the fact that I wanted to go back to a situation where the hard work that I had done, the real thought that I had put into each creative choice, wasn't gainsayed by somebody's first blush opinion of it. Yeah, but why don't you do this instead? Well, because I spent months thinking about it and figuring out that that way was the better way to do it. And if you stop and think about it, instead of trying to make sure your fingerprints are all over the manuscript, you will see actually that, yes, it was better as originally constructed. I'm not averse to editors, and there certainly have been times where David and others have given me very fine advice. But David, I do believe, was, he called himself an old-fashioned editor, blah, blah, blah. I do believe that he felt to some degree that he was co-author of the piece and that that was an inappropriate level of intrusion. I happen to be the science fiction columnist for Galaxy's Edge magazine, edited by Mike Resnick, and my latest column, Decoherence column in the magazine, is on that very topic. Specifically, specific edits David asked me to make in Mind Scan and Rollback, two of my novels that I objected to. you if people are interested in following up and learning more about this. But so, yeah, I love handing in a manuscript. As my editor, Adrian Kerr at Penguin Canada, said of Wake, I wish you would, you know, I wish there was a comma that you would make me have to change, right? just so she felt that she'd earned her money in the process.
Unfortunately, I can't say mine are quite that clean, but that is certainly something to aim for. When you write science fiction, you are writing about a fictional world, but I think it's safe to say, particularly in your case, that you are hoping that your shaping of your fictional world will somehow influence and shape the real world. Would you say that's fair?
Yes. This is the observer effect in quantum mechanics, right? You cannot observe a situation without changing the situation. So, you know, when we look at the great works of science fiction, one of them is 1984. Well, lo and behold, the year 1984 did not turn out to be like the year that George Orwell wrote about in 1948. Is George Orwell a failure? No, of course not. Because of his warning about Big Brother, it took us all the way to 2018 to end up in George Orwell's 1984, right? Where we were told that the news was a lie, that we were told that this actually means its opposite, that we were blah, 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 right? You know, George Orwell predicted, in essence, state-run propaganda news agencies. What he did not predict is that people would willingly tune into them in their 100 million in the United States with Fox News, rather than exercising their right to turn them off. So George Orwell changed the landscape and postponed for decades, and still informs enormously our discourse about the present world of totalitarianism and of newspeak and the death of believing the evidence of your own eyes, of empirical evidence, scientific evidence, mattering in our decision-making process. Obviously, he was a gigantic success in that regard. Of course, the best of the classic Star Trek or Twilight Zone was also trying to do the same sort of thing. Margaret Atwood, when she wrote The Handmaid's Tale, was desperately trying to tell the world that women's reproductive rights, there was a thin edge of the wedge back in there. Yes, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, but not in the United States, but nonetheless, there are people making assailing this, and she desperately hoped to, of course, derail any further inroads and indeed reverse controlling women's bodies by old men. Well, perhaps, again, she hasn't succeeded as fully as she wished. I do sometimes wonder about the futility of science fiction, that at best we manage to forestall for a few decades what the situation is going to be. You know, Santa Anna said, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. I say those who read science fiction are doomed to live through it just a few decades later, thanks to the good offices of science fiction, than they otherwise would have had to.
Clearly, it's something that in your own fiction you aim at. Do you feel you've succeeded?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It is difficult. I think that I have helped inform some discourse on gender relations with hominids, humans, and hybrids. I was extremely proud that two of the three volumes were nominated for the Galactic Spectrum Awards. This is way before all this discussion about diversity, which has been at the front and center of science fiction the last 36 months or so. I was being honored for being inclusive of LGBTQ lifestyles at the dawn of this millennium. I'm very proud of the ethnic diversity. I remember my novel Terminal Experiment, 1995. I got one review of the book that called it a veritable parade of ethnics because there were so many non-white characters in the book. Now I look around my Toronto 20-odd years later, and it is precisely the world that I see. It was obvious that Toronto was going to, and Canada and the world was going to become more and more multicultural and polyglot as time went on. And I do feel, yes, that I've been a small part of a movement, a literary and social movement that has helped shape our reality in small ways. I wish, as you know, anybody who does world building is the title of your podcast,
actually,
is in some ways...
World builders,
because of your forthcoming DAW book, the world builders, right?
No, it's world shapers.
World shapers. Let's get the plug in here. World shapers. Okay, but the concept of world building is in some ways the most arrogant concept in science fiction. The notion that whether you're a theist who says that it took a supernatural, superintelligent being to create our world, or... you're an atheist who says it took 13.8 billion years of incredibly intricate unfolding of the consequences of the laws of physics and ultimately the laws of biology to get where we are today, and to say, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to spend a week world building my novel, as if we have any hope of approaching in the minutest level the amount of detail and interconnectivity and contradiction that makes up any real world, that makes up any real town. Maybury RFD, a made-up town based on Mount Airy, a real town in I think, North Carolina or South Carolina, I forget which one. Mount Airy is the real town that kind of inspired Maybury. Maybury is made up. You look at Maybury RFD, if you actually watch the Andy Griffith Show, you'll see the population of Maybury varies from about 1,800 people to over 10,000 people, depending on the exigencies of the particular story that they happen to be telling that week. It's not a real place, but those who claim, oh, Maybury, it was so real, it was just like the place I grew up in. It was full of holes. You, my friend, of course, are well known for your other life, which is in live theater. You worked with Tatiana Maslany before she was a star of Orphan Black. You're a great actor, and you know that in live theater, set decoration is an art. Set design is an art. What 2, 3, 4, 5 pieces of setting of and prop can I put on a stage that will suggest a whole world, that will suggest this is the 1880s in Regina, or suggest that it's 2018 in Toronto, or suggest it's ancient Rome, or what have you, right? Which few details. And really, most world building is not what we've described in this last hour, or not the incredibly obsessive work, say, that J.R.R. Tolkien did for Middle Earth, but is in fact a few random pieces of set decoration and a couple of props that give the illusion that a much more real, much more carefully thought out world actually exists. It is a form of stage magic.
And that is great, because that was exactly what I was about to talk about, and the kind of my premise that this whole thing came out of is that authors are not so much building worlds as shaping worlds, hence the actual title of the podcast.
Yes, that's right.
We're taking a real world and we are shaping, or even taking just a portion of it and shaping it into something that looks like reality but isn't reality. And the last thing I want to get to, and I may have to edit one or two things out of here to keep this down to an hour, but the last thing I wanted to get to was an argument that I've made, and I'd just like to get your opinion on it, which is that there are those who draw a distinction between mainstream fiction and science fiction because they like to read about the real world. And my argument has been, as I've made talks the last little while, that even someone who is writing mainstream literary fiction is making up their world every bit as much as somebody who's writing up science fiction. It's not the real world. It's way thinner, doesn't have all the detail. It's a shaped version of the real world, but it's no more real than what Tolkien makes up. Do you think that's fair?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you completely. And in fact, if you look, most people will very happily read mystery fiction. What's the fundamental precept of mystery fiction? If you commit a crime, you won't get away with it. You will be caught. What's our reality? The exact opposite. Almost no crime gets detected, and even most murders go unsolved. It's just the reality of life. Romance fiction, you will find your one true love and it'll be happily ever after. More than half of all marriages in those jurisdictions that allow divorce end in divorce. There's absolutely no correlation between what we take as the cornerstones of our so-called mimetic mainstream fiction and the reality most of us really live in. We go into them for an escape, to a world in which justice triumphs, or true love triumphs, or a world in which the incredibly self-indulgent minutiae of one's individual life story really matters. Miriam Taves is a great, great Canadian writer, and the title of one of her books I love, and it's not her title, she took it from another work, is All My Puny Sorrows. And that sums up so much of mainstream literature. It's like, no, all this little incredibly irrelevant stuff is important and meaningful. No, actually everybody goes through pretty much the same stuff. And in the end, it really it doesn't matter much. And here's a book. But my latest book, Quantum Night, is about the rise of right-wing authoritarianism, totalitarianism in what had previously been liberal Western societies. You can think it's a good thing, you can think it's a bad thing, but the fact is I'm talking about the same reality that we devote now about all of our news cycle to these days. And that makes it much more relevant. Science fiction is the literature of rational extrapolation of from where we are now to where we might conceivably be in the future. Mainstream fiction is the fantasy that the little lives of people really do amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world.
Well, we'll always have Paris.
We'll always have Paris.
And just to close off, what are you working on now?
So 2 years from now, 2020, July 16th, will be the 75th anniversary of the dawn of the atomic age, the Trinity test at Alamogordo, New Mexico. And of course, 3 weeks later, the dawn of the age of the atomic warfare with the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I'm writing an alternate history of the Manhattan Project called the Oppenheimer Alternative. For the first time ever in the history of science, science and public policy really crammed together in World War II. Whether it was the science of the Allies who were making atomic weapons, or the science of the Axis who were working out how to effectively dispose of 6 million Jews and the huge quantities of Roma and homosexuals and intellectuals using industrial techniques on a vast scale. Either way, for the first time really in the history of the world, world events turned on scientists, and many came to have regrets on both sides, of course, the Axis and the Allies, for their roles in the Second World War. Many of the Manhattan Project scientists went on to be great peace campaigners after the reality of what they created came home to roost for them. And so I'm writing a novel. My big theme is the moral obligations of scientists to the world, the new world that they're inventions create, and its book is called The Oppenheimer Alternative, and I'm aiming for it to be in bookstores just before that 75th anniversary, so there'll be a lot of promotional opportunities for it.
2 years from almost today.
That's right. I'll be on book tour, so you can repeat this podcast in 2 years.
It's not going anywhere. It should be lingering until everybody's sick of listening to it. Well, thank you so much, Rob. I really appreciate it.
Ed, it's always a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you in Ottawa at CanCon. I always love running into you. Be well, my friend.
Well, thank you, Rob, and thanks to everyone who has listened to this very first episode of The World Shapers. You can find Robert J. Sawyer online at his website at sfreiter.com. You can also find me online at my website, edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett, W-I-L-L-E-T-T. Something to remember also if you're looking for me on Twitter, where I am at ewillett, E-W-I-L-L-E-T-T. You can find this podcast online at theworldshapers.com and on Twitter at tworldshapers. It's also on Facebook. If you search it up, you'll find me there too, if you search me up, oddly enough. I'd just like to mention before I close off here some of my latest books that are available. I have a collection of science fiction and fantasy poetry of all things, illustrated by wonderful Alberta artist Wendy Nordell. That's available in print, ebook, and audiobook format. Another recent project of mine was a five-book young adult fantasy series called The Shards of Excalibur, published by Coteau Books, and it's currently coming out in ebook I'm sorry, coming out in audiobook, narrated by the wonderful Elizabeth Klett. So please look for those as they come out. My other things that are out at the moment include a collection of short stories called Paths to the Stars, published by Shadowpaw Press. And my most recent novel, published by Daw Books, The City Born, a standalone science fiction novel, which is now out in mass market paperback and still available in hardcover and ebook formats. And finally, of course, coming up September 18th, which will be in either the future or the past, depending on when you listen to this, World Shaper, starting the new series World Shapers. It's my 9th novel for Daw Books, and of course, it is indeed the book from which this entire podcast takes its title. That's it for this time around. Thank you once again for being part of the very first episode of The World Shapers. I had a great time. I hope you did too, with Robert J. Sawyer, and I hope you'll come back over and over again as I continue to have fascinating conversations with the people who shape the fantastical worlds of science fiction and fantasy. I will be back. I hope you will too. Bye for now.